This is WGN. Happy Saturday night. It is the Mincing Rascals on WGN's Saturday Night Special. We're sitting in for the great Amy Guth. We'll be back next week. Check her out. With me tonight, and it's a great show. I know everyone always says that, but let's live up to it. On my right, of course, Scott Stanis, the editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune.
No pressure for a great show. Yeah, this is going to be out of the park, man.
It'll be out of the park.
Absolutely, no pressure. That voice you hear also is Susan Schmidt. You know her from Rokoncho. She fills in on occasion there. She does our weekly market recap. And she is from Westwood in Dallas.
Yes.
She's not on Twitter yet, so we're trying to get her there.
Yeah, I'm still working up to this new technology. Yeah. I hear there's this thing called Twitter. I don't know.
Pace yourself.
Right. You're not don't on rush. Yourself. Don't rush.
Twitter's almost over. I would get on it quickly.
And that voice you hear, of course, is Eric Zorn from the Tribune as well. The feisty Tribune columnist you
That's
hear
right.
him on.
Exactly. Thank Bill you
and
for
Wendy.
Remembering.
Yes, absolutely. How could I forget? What a show we have for us tonight. 2 hours here from 7 to 9. If you want to join the show, 312-981-7200. We will gladly take your calls. You'll have to talk to Rachel to get to us, so be nice. But big show. So we'll talk about with Stacey St. Clair will join us a little later, talk some Olympics. Ryan Lochte, who's been sucking up all the oxygen in the room. But someone else who's been sucking up lots of oxygen is Donald Trump, shaking up things this week. I know, get right into it, but I know we were talking about it before we kicked off here. So
we did. We're done.
So we're done, yeah. We spent it all, but we saved a little for the air, I hope.
We did.
Scott, what do you think of the shake-up here?
I think with the shake-ups, he's had a good couple of days. Eric has a great take on that, which I happen to think he's right, which you will not hear often during this show. He had a good couple of days. I thought his speech in Milwaukee was good. I thought the fact that Hillary and President Obama didn't bother to go to Louisiana, and he did. You can dismiss it, but I think the optics were just right. And so, you know, he's had a good couple of days, given that he had the worst possible 10 days
leading
up to
that. The optics were very good for him going to – you're right. The optics were really good that he went down to Louisiana. The reason that Obama – one of the reasons that Obama hasn't gone to Louisiana was the governor doesn't want him down there. The governor was on MSNBC the other day saying, it's a huge drain on us when the president of the United States comes down. When Biden came down, we had to divert all these first responders to protect the president, make sure that the freeways are cleared and everything like that. But I concede the point. That's a fine point. And there's a reason Hillary Clinton couldn't have gone down there, I suppose.
But I think the optics were good for him because it was finally a positive moment. He'd
right.
had so many negatives in a row mm-hmm. that something that was neutral to slightly positive
and he looked,
looked good.
And human.
For him.
Yeah, it's very human. And I think that's a great point. That is something positive. It is the big knock on him. No question here. He's not presidential enough. People don't accept him as being somebody who they can see in that office. And this gave him an opportunity to be that guy. He could show up with a tough time. I'm here. Let's fix things. Let's make people feel
better. But I think the bigger issue here is, can he execute that twice? Right. Can he do it two times in a row? Because he doesn't seem to be able to do anything consistently.
Well, he apologized. I mean, he did apologize, and that's the thing.
After that fashion.
Sure.
Yeah,
absolutely, in his own way. But from him, that's still something.
Well, he expressed regret. He said, sometimes you say things that hurt people, and I've done that, and I regret it.
And calling them fat pigs and saying that some senator's father killed Kennedy. Yeah, sometimes you say that.
It just
happens. You make fun of the disabled. It happens. It happens.
It happens to the best of us.
It happens
us,
to
yes.
all of us. No, I thought his speech in Milwaukee where he addressed the African-American community saying and making the invitation, you can't expand a party unless you invite people first, and then he's going to have to
this
lay down.
Was the insight that the Republicans had 4 years ago, which is they needed a broader tent, and then they got this crazy guy as their nominee who manages to alienate every one of these groups that they thought they needed to bring into their tent.
He essentially punched a hole in the side of the tent, went in it that way, and now he's lighting fire to the tablecloth.
What's stunning to me is the Republicans, and you look at the polling, and all of a sudden, Republicans are going, wait, we nominated who?
Right.
I mean, this was a surprise. This was like a slow motion avalanche. You saw it coming. You couldn't have been surprised.
But what's interesting is the stock market's done the exact same thing. So if you look at it, the stock market has not focused on the election at all year to date. And so we've seen no ripples, really, from Trump, Hillary, completely uncertain what they're going to do with the economy. So that should be rife with unknowns and concern, and you should see volatility in the stock market because of that. And the stock market completely ignored it. They focused on big things like China and Brexit.
But what happened with Brexit? There was a big disruption with Brexit originally, just came back.
24 hours of disruption, and then it was gone.
And then their market went down. The pound, the euro collapses, and it's like nothing's going to happen for 2 years. It was the biggest freak out.
Well, now the euro didn't actually collapse. The euro held together. The British pound. did lose it. So I always say, if anyone's thinking about a vacation this summer, go to Britain. This is the time. I mean, the dollar pound rate has never been better. It truly hasn't been better in like 30 years. So what's interesting is this Trump issue, there large pockets of society seem to have ignored the fact that he is now the Republican candidate. Like, he's the guy.
Think about this. We're going to have a debate, and I'm hopeful. I'll be straightforward and hoping that we'll have a third podium up there with Gary Johnson and William Weld from the Libertarian Party. But just the two of them, you're going to have Donald Trump step on the presidential debate stage and stand behind that podium and do that stupid hand gesture. And with his tiny little freakish hands.
Okay. Yeah, that's his tagline. Okay.
Okay. It would be great. Believe me. He says at the end of everything.
He's, you know, everyone who's, you know, underestimated him in these debates has paid a big price.
And I'm one of them.
I'm certainly one of them, too. I mean, I thought that he was going to be a buffoon in the debates. And starting about a year ago, he managed to destroy about every one of his opponents.
But because he's non-traditional in the way he debates, he doesn't engage in the way that people are used to. It's not necessarily logical. He'll turn it. He turns it to emotion. He turns it to personal. And I think that's how he's gotten ahead, is that he's so unconventional in his style. That's what really, no one was prepared for that. It threw everyone off.
Well, here's what I said that Scott, I think, might agree with, which is that we're talking right now about Donald Trump is able to reset himself, to pivot, to say, here's the new Donald Trump. And that people may buy this, and that there's no way that Hillary Clinton can reset anything, right? I mean, her reputation is baked into the cake. She's had, you know, 25 years of being investigated and pilloried for everything she's done. There's no way that she can, like, turn around her reputation for honesty, right?
Right. Well, she could start.
People think that she could, but she's more honest than Donald Trump is. Trump is a much bigger liar. That all the fact check places will tell you that Trump just lies and lies and lies. And
he just throws out whatever comes into his head.
But it's Clinton who's going to live with that not trustworthy label. She's not going to be able to turn that around no matter what she says, because there's no reinvention of Hillary Clinton. Trump has gone so far into the trough that inevitably the stories that we're going to be writing and talking about are going to be like Trump on the ascendant. Trump has changed. It's a new Trump. And that's going to help him in the polls. He's not going to lose, I don't think, by what, 10 points? What's he down in a lot of these polls?
It depends. Yeah, it's a lot.
He's not going to lose by that much. I don't think our electorate is that... Is that much of a swing?
And to be fair, Hillary did try the reset button. It was with Russia, and
right.
That didn't go.
There was a Staples button, though, I think, right?
Yeah.
So what we need to do is elect a guy who's pals with Russia, who thinks Putin's a great guy. So
yeah. Well, and Putin's got what, 40,000 troops on the Ukrainian border today with armored divisions, and the president plays golf. It's awesome.
Yes. Well, but it hasn't been necessarily a perfect week for Hillary either. She's got issues coming out. The Clinton Foundation has now said that they will probably most likely not take any money from foreign donors.
I just love
if we become
okay.
President.
You know, right now when she was Secretary of State, it was okay. But now as president,
maybe.
We may draw the line there. So,
it sort of reminds me of Madigan and Lisa and Mike when he's, you know, Speaker of the House, and she was thinking of running for governor a few years back, and he decides he's not going to retire ever. And so she said it would be unseemly to have a governor and a speaker of in the same family, but it's okay to have a speaker and an attorney general in the same family.
Well, because the attorney general doesn't have that much power.
Clearly, we haven't had corruption prosecution in the state in over a decade.
Well, we haven't had corruption prosecutions by Illinois attorney generals for much longer than that. I mean, well, people say that about Lisa Madigan, but look at the attorney generals before that. It's never been a tradition for Illinois attorney generals to prosecute corruption. Now, you could say that it should have been, but it hasn't been. Jim Ryan, the Republican who before you were here was attorney general, he didn't do any corruption prosecutions either, so let's be fair. And the other thing about the Madigan thing is at least the voters have a say in that, right? I mean, the voters elected Lisa Madigan, and I raised a stink about what when Lisa Madigan ran the first time. It didn't write, and I didn't think she was qualified to be attorney general. But the voters said otherwise.
But going back to the Clinton Foundation, now all of a sudden the Clintons are recognizing that, well, maybe it stinks a little bit, but it doesn't stink enough to like totally like distance yourself from it. So happily, there'll still be money there for Senator Chelsea, and thank God for that.
Oh, thank God indeed. Speaking of corruption, it's probably a golden era of corruption coming up in this country, the states, all across the board, with the closing of Gawker, because we all know they were on the hot tails of all corruption around the world. I'd love to get your guys' take on Gawker collapsing and folding shop shortly here, but let's take a quick break. This is WGN, the Mincing Rascals on WGN Saturday Night Special. Stay with us. We'll be right back. The great Chicago Tribune brings us, of course, Eric Zorn and Scott Stanis here on the Mincing Rascals. That's you guys. We're in for the Saturday Night Special. Amy Guth will be back next weekend. And Susan Schmidt is here from Westwood in Dallas. You can hear her on the Rokan Show on Fridays or whenever Anna needs a day off.
She's a senior vice president.
That's right.
Senior vice president. She has her eyes on everything. Before we went to the break, we were talking about the idea of corruption, which I know is very new to people who live in Illinois and Chicago. But it ties into a story that I think is kind of interesting. The idea that the website Gawker is going under they faced Hulk Hogan and they lost. For those of you who didn't see it, but Gawker is kind of a fringe news site. I use that term loosely, but they will be going out of business next week. And I think it's an interesting sign. And we talked about this a little bit before we started the show, but the idea that these websites face the music and wind up having to go to court and defend themselves when they do things that are untoward, and they call themselves journalists at times, but I don't think anyone in this room would agree with that.
And Gawker is not totally disappearing. So Gawker itself is going down, but Gawker has several brands, and it's being bought by Univision for $135 million. So it's being picked up, and it's going to be absorbed into another entity and keep going. And I think Gawker, it's great to see them held accountable for what they have to do. I think there's another interesting backstory to this, which is that a very wealthy tech investor used the Hulk Hogan case to come after Gawker to take them down.
Yeah, that's the aspect of this story that leaves me feeling uncomfortable. Obviously, you know, the fact that they ran, I mean, just to back up for people who may not have been following this story, Gawker aired how many seconds of the Hulk Hogan sex tape? Not a whole lot, but they aired portions of the Hulk Hogan sex tape. And then the suit against Gawker on behalf of Hogan was funded by this guy who was angry at Gawker for outing him, right?
Peter Thiel.
Peter Thiel had a grudge against Gawker because, yes, they had outed him. He had been very quiet about his homosexuality, and they had outed him early on, and Gawker had all the dirt about the Silicon Valley guys going around, and he held a grudge, and he happens to be a very successful entrepreneur who has amassed hundreds of millions and has the ability to single-handedly do this. And so Hulk Hogan was the weapon of choice, if you will.
Which it makes me uneasy, the fact that if it had gone through just a normal channel, but the fact that this guy
the motives on this are kind of weird. It's great that someone was held accountable, right? We need to see that. We need to have that. We need to feel that applies not only to, you know, we just talked about print media not that long ago. Print media, you think there's a standard, and you always have to wonder about where did this come from when you pull it up on the website. I think you need to have that accountability, but it's interesting to see the motive behind this because it was very directed by one individual.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, on the one hand, as a journalist, and Eric's the same way, we virtually grew up in newsrooms, so we grew up around journalists, and so you see that what Gawker was doing is kind of like good riddance to bad garbage, you know, but on the other hand, seeing the conspiratorial aspect of this, that this was a guy with a whole ton of money going after a media outlet he didn't like, because it did something which, frankly, kind of stinks. You know, when you out someone, it just doesn't want to be outed, then don't out them. But
that was, I think, worse, categorically worse than showing snippets of this sex tape that were all over the internet anyway, right? I mean, that there were other places where that sex tape was available, I'm told.
Right. Yes.
Well, as a musician, Eric, I have to ask you, is Hulk Hogan sex tape, is that a name for a band?
Could be.
Mincing
yes.
Rascals is. I mean, but
Hulk Hogan's sex tape. That is a good name for a band.
Yeah.
It has a good ring to it. Speaking of conspiracy theories, and I don't want to fall back on Trump too much, but the idea of Roger Ailes kind of helping, and it goes again from this whole mentality of new journalism or new news where people are getting their media from, helping out Donald Trump in the debates, and we kind of glossed over this earlier, but helping him prep. Yay, nay, you think it's going to be good
for him? Well, he's not with Fox anymore. He got himself caught doing naughty things and was wrong. But I think, you know, I'm sorry, Ms. Schmidt.
Yes. Well, yes, he did get himself caught doing naughty things, which apparently he'd been doing for years.
Nice. Gee whiz. What a scumbag.
There we go. And so that makes it very difficult. I don't know that we talked about Trump's image. I don't know that there's necessarily an association being made in the voters' mind between Trump and Ailes.
I think Trump and Fox, if you watch it, I have to admit, I hadn't watched it in months, and I turned it on, and holy Mary, mother of God, they have lost their crap. This is crazy how pro-Trump they are. And clearly, now Ailes is working for them. I think we're coming into an age, too. We talked about diminishment of Gawker, but also just the idea that, you know, you see newspapers going away and local coverage. Mm-hmm. I think you're going to see the end of nonpartisan coverage of issues. You know, remember, newspapers until the 1950s or 60s were, you had the so, you know, you could have had the, you know, the Naperville Democrat or the so-and-so Republican or the so-and-so Independent. They had a point of view. I mean, the Chicago Tribune started because it was a Republican newspaper, and we got Lincoln the nomination and got him elected. He hasn't thanked us enough, to be honest. But my point is, I think that we may be coming back into the age of partisan coverage of journalism, like a Fox News, like an MSNBC. I don't know if that's good or bad.
There certainly seems to be an appetite for it, that CNN is kind of mired in the ratings, and Fox is doing much better. I mean, Fox is way more partisan than CNN, right? I mean, CNN tries to play it more down the middle.
I mean, it seems like viewers are attracted to that, right? They want one extreme or another. We've definitely moved into this era of extreme sensationalism. Normal, balanced view is not good media these days because it's boring.
Do you remember back when they launched Windows 98? I mean, this is how old I am. I can remember that. And Bill Gates, for some reason, when you're the richest man on the planet, you have to sound like Kermit the Frog. And he goes, when you get this new thing, when you can look at only news that you want to look at. I'm thinking, that is the worst idea I've ever heard in my entire life, because I don't want confirmation of my ideas. I want my ideas challenged. Apparently, I'm in a minority.
It would certainly seem so.
Well, I would think that's true. I just wanted to circle back a little bit to Roger Ailes. I think that the advisor to Trump who may end up having much more sway with him in these debates is going to be Kellyanne Conway, his new campaign manager, who is a Republican strategist. This is her first campaign that she's ever managed. But I saw her the other day being interviewed, and she is very strong. And I think we've already seen some influence from her in the way Trump has moderated himself and modulated himself over the past week. And he's very hard to control, clearly, but she might be able to get into his head in terms of these debates, things to stay away from, things not to say. Ailes is famous for giving people good one-liners, right? I mean, that's his kind of he gives people zingers and so on. But if she's going to work on his temperament, which is going to be an issue, because that's going to be the issue that Clinton's going to be running on, is this guy the guy you want when we have another?
Well, and that's what she's going to be if I were going to go debate Trump, right? That's where you would bait him. You want to see him lose it on stage. And so let's have him lose it in the middle. Clinton's tactic should be to push and push. So I think we have seen Trump moderate. As we said, he's on an upswing now at the end of the week.
If you were talking to Hillary, how would you tell her to debate him, Donald Trump? I think that's a heck of a challenge. If you're advising, you know.
It is a heck of a challenge because, as we've seen, we just talked about, he 17 people came out trying to get the Republican, you know, nomination, and he managed to take down all of them. And I'm arguing
some seasoned veterans too.
His unconventional style. And I think Hillary's got enough poise. The concern about Trump that seems to resonate most, from what I've observed, is he's got this really erratic personality. And if he's president, he has the nuclear codes.
He doesn't know much. This is the thing that Trump really is not. I mean, he may have a very high IQ. He brags about it. But he doesn't know. He doesn't read a lot. And I think that what I would do if I were advising Hillary is I would advise her to go after him on specifics. I would do some of the things like, when you're dealing with, can you tell me who you would deal with if you're going to be, negotiating Syria or Pakistan? Which leaders would you talk to?
I think that is exactly what would work, because when he doesn't know something, he gets agitated.
Absolutely. We'll get to Kristen McQuarrie's take on all things State House, because she's a State House chick, coming up on the other side of the news. But first, happy Saturday evening on 720 WGN. This is the Mincing Rascals on WGN Saturday Night Special. Amy Guth will be back next week. Sitting in the studio, of We've got Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune, Susan Schmidt from Westwood in Dallas, and of course Scott Stannis. Welcome, welcome all, and
thanks for having us.
Thank you.
This is fun
on this dreary these. Aaron Water Show. Oh, is it clearing up?
It's cleared up. Unpredictable day. It's been on and off.
It certainly is. Poor Water Show. I hear Charles Tillman is bumping. For those who don't know, Susan Schmidt fills in and sits in on the Rokan Show, which I produce during a week here. And our own Violetta Podromedic is supposed to jump tomorrow morning to kick off the Aaron Water Show with the Golden Knights. But because of the weather today, she's getting bumped by Charles Tillman, who is supposed to kick it off. And so she's going to be doing the afternoon.
She gets the afternoon jump.
Yeah.
He's retired.
I know.
That's just not right.
I know.
If he wanted to jump, he should have stayed in the NFL.
There you go.
Well, got some standards around this place.
I know. Somebody who does have standards and is joining us now, Kristen McQuarrie of the Tribune Editorial Board. Kristen, good evening.
Hello. How are you all?
Hey, how are you?
Good.
Kristen is a regular on the Mincing Rascals podcast. Of course, she pops up on the John Cass podcast, which I also help produce. And Scott sat in with us a couple times, the Chicago Way, so check that out, too.
She's all over the place. She was on the Week in Review in Chicago Tonight.
She was. Yeah. She was sneering at someone. Who were you sneering at there, Kristen?
Sneering there. I don't know about that.
You posted to Facebook.
I'm here to set you all straight, so just let me know when you want me to start digging in on all of your commentary for the past 35 minutes.
Okay, go.
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 And honor the great John McLaughlin. McQuarrie, go.
Right, issue number one.
Okay. I have to bring you to a little bit of levity here. Like, you've been going off on Trump. Let me begin by saying I am not a Trump supporter. I will not be voting for Trump. But what I am is someone who watches very closely when the media jumps on him in a way they do not jump on Hillary Clinton. And that's what you've been doing for the past 35 minutes. Like, you're talking about, you're referring to him as, you know, a crazy man, even though he had, what, 13 million people vote for him. You don't jump on Hillary Clinton's advisors, who include Anthony Weiner's wife. Can you imagine if that situation with Anthony Weiner and his wife were unfolding on the Trump side and you had a top Trump advisor whose husband was revealing himself?
Well, Kristen, I'm sorry. We have a new aide for him who ran Fox News and had a long and storied history of sexual harassment. So it is there.
Well, okay, then go look at Hillary's supporters. Have you looked into John Podesta's history or all of her connections to trying to ameliorate relations with Russia, and the fact that the Associated Press, not a partisan news organization, has reported that 20,000 of her private emails during the time that she was Secretary of State, the Russians hacked. But we're all going to focus on Trump's campaign manager's relationship with this Ukrainian organization. But we're not going to look at Hillary Clinton and what she risked of national security and what the Associated Press has reported. I mean, come on. Like, we're just, again, I just have to repeat, I am not a Trump.
That's why you're here, Kristen. That's why we called.
First of all, Humit Abedin, who is Clinton's advisor and Anthony Weiner's wife, I mean, you can't blame the wife for what Anthony Weiner did. She's the victim.
Eric, if she were a top advisor to Trump and all of this news were coming out about her, you would be all over it. You would be saying it's reflective of his campaign, that he is a misogynist, that he is sexist, that he is out of control. You would absolutely be using that as fuel to the fire against Trump.
I don't hold spouses' activities against politicians. I really don't.
But. I'm not saying you. I'm saying general media.
Okay.
greater you.
If that story were unfolding on the Trump side of the campaign, it would be on CNN, you know, every 15 minutes.
But what I mean, wouldn't I mean, if it were the actual, you know, person who took the picture of his private parts and sent them around, if that person were on the campaign, that's one thing. That, you know, guilt by this kind of guilt by association stuff is, I mean, at some point you got to draw the line, and I would draw it there. But anyway,
you think if that were a top Trump advisor,
a spouse of a top Trump advisor, a spouse,
yes, and that story were unfolding, that you wouldn't be all over it as a sign that is a campaign that is just.
No.
You know, out of control, and okay.
I don't think that's fair, and I think the Trump campaign, in fact, is running a risk in attacking Bill Clinton, trying to attack Hillary Clinton through Bill Clinton, saying, well, look at all the bad things Bill Clinton did, and Hillary Clinton's a lot of people see her as his victim, not as his enabler, but anyway. But let's talk about these emails. I haven't followed that exact wrinkle in the story. The 20,000 emails, the AP says the Russians have them.
When she was Secretary of State?
Right. So this was a story from October of 2015 where it was confirmed basically that Russia had hacked about 20,000 of Clinton's emails on five different occasions during the time that she was Secretary of State. Now, what came of those, I don't know that there is a thread that leads us there, but it just, you know, when we keep looking at Paul Manafort, who is Trump's campaign manager, who has been fired, and his connections because he was paid by this person, but we're not going to give the same scrutiny to Hillary Clinton, who, you know, by unbiased news sources put the nation at risk because she had this unsecured server.
How much
more
scrutiny do you want on this email story? It's been covered and covered and covered. People have talked about it. They talk about it endlessly. She was on TV for 12 hours talking about it. I mean, I'm not saying it's not a deal. I'm saying it's been looked at and talked about quite a bit.
I just think that the back and forth and the comparisons are not readily made, where you are going to go after Trump for something that you sort of let Hillary Clinton take a pass on, or that, you know, you gave her some scrutiny 8 months ago, but there's no connection now that makes sense that you would maybe think twice about the way you're going after the Trump campaign.
Well, I think that Clinton has handled the email thing poorly, and I think that she has clearly made a mistake what she did. It's not clear to me that there's been any real consequences to that. She did put the nation's security at risk for doing this, but I'm not sure that there were any real world consequences.
And
to
I can tell you from my perspective, you know, and you know my politics. I'm kind of right, conservative guy. Worked in Republican politics high school and college, but I think the reason that Trump infuriates me is because he is so anathema to everything I believe that politics can be and should be. So if I go off on that tangent a little too much, that's the reason why. You can't say we went off on Hillary a little bit, but we're doing it now. I think it's hilarious that her excuse over the last 24 hours has been, well, you know, I talked to Colin Powell about this, and he said it was okay. A, that's preposterous, and B, why would you pick someone? I mean, if she's going to say stuff like that, why not say William Jennings Bryan or someone who's already dead?
This was in the notes. This was in the notes of the FBI. This is a leak from somebody. The FBI gave the notes of the conversation. She's not saying it now.
What I thought she said it within the last 36 hours. She said something, or
I thought it was a leaked part of the notes from the FBI.
Well,
but she had said it before, though. She had said, well, because Colin Powell was her predecessor.
I thought Condoleezza Rice was.
Well, I mean, one of her predecessors, and that was one of the excuses she gave.
He said it was okay. That's preposterous. I mean, again, why not just say, you know, Daniel Webster? He was
because he had email, and he did use a private email address, but he did not use a private server. I mean, there's no question that Hillary Clinton messed up doing this. I mean, you know why she did it, too.
Sure, the Clinton Foundation.
No, it wasn't because of that.
Of course it was.
No, it wasn't.
Of course it was.
Well, not. I mean,
but I think this is indicative. Is, you know, and Chris and I appreciate your point. And I think it's indicative of the styles of the two candidates, right? Trump is so sensational and such a different approach in everything that he does that he, like him or not, you focus on everything. Hillary, because she's a known quantity, it's not new. It's nothing surprising. She doesn't get the attention because people say, well, yeah, I know that brand.
It's baked in the cake already.
But yeah, I've seen it.
She doesn't get the attention because she doesn't even do press conferences. Like, if she actually
she stays super low profile.
But that's why. Because, I mean, there is still, as of recent stories, FBI investigations looking at the overlap between donors to the Clinton Foundation and special treatment from the State Department. I mean, that is still an ongoing issue, and it gets completely, I shouldn't say completely, it gets brushed under the rug because Trump is so bombastic and he says something crazy and the press runs after that story. But that is a serious issue if, in fact, there were overlapping issues between raising money for the Clinton Foundation and State Department favors. FBI sources, nonpartisan people, but speaking anonymously to legit news sources, saying that there might have been violations of three or four different public corruption laws. But again, we're just going to ignore that, and we're just going to focus on what Trump said that was so crazy about a baby or whatever at this rally.
Well, so far, that's partly that Trump's fault. Trump's problem is that he gives so many openings like that. He puts so many cookies on the bottom shelf for the media. But the other thing, though, is that, you know, we're talking, a lot of this is conjectural, the Clinton Foundation stuff. I mean, you talk about, you know, Stott thinks that the reason she did this was because she wanted to do nefarious Clinton Foundation business in secret. I don't think so. I think the reason she did it is because she's paranoid. And because of all the years, she just didn't want anyone to get into any of her business. So she wanted to keep control of all of her email. I don't think there's been anything that you're going to find. So far, there has been nothing that we found that says that she was using her office.
So that's the campaign slogan. She's not crooked. She's paranoid.
Well, she's certainly is paranoid. And you can understand why she's paranoid, too. I mean, right. I mean, people thought she'd kill Fitz.
So that justifies her breaking the law?
No. I didn't say that.
Petraeus got indicted and convicted because he was trying to hide an extramarital affair. So it's okay for her to go ahead and put national secrets and security at risk because she's paranoid as a public figure?
He wasn't indicted over hiding an affair. It was the information exchange.
He deliberately gave information to someone he shouldn't have. Hillary Clinton did not deliberately give anybody anything. No one has said that. I mean, she may have put it at risk. The one may have found it, but there's a difference between what those two people did.
No, Petraeus,
Mark Kirk's going to vote for Petraeus anyway.
And Petraeus used it for dating. So
yes, exactly. Okay, so on that point,
has Mark Kirk's vote, so we're good.
Yes, Chrissy, can you stick with us for a few more minutes? We'll take a quick break. We'd like to get thoughts on some more local, bring things home to here to WGN 720 Chicago. We'll be right back.
It's Democrats.
All righty, this is 720 WGN. It is Saturday. This is the Mincing Rascal sitting in for the Saturday Night Special. Amy Guth will be back next week.
She's in like Vermont tapping sap or something, right?
That sounds like something she would do.
Sure.
Absolutely. That voice is Scott Stannis, Chicago Tribune. He's my favorite cartoonist.
Oh, thank you.
I do appreciate that. And thanks for sitting in. S. Stantis, yes, on Twitter. Check him out. And check everybody
also
on
go
show.
To a Prickly City podcast.
Yep, Prickly City podcast.
WGN Plus.
Absolutely.
There's nothing I don't
You're
do.
Really branding yourself well. I really appreciate this. This is nice.
Any forthcoming books?
A clothing line. He's
my favorite cartoonist.
Some sports sandals, maybe.
That voice is Susan Schmidt from Westwood Financial, or Westwood Holdings, I apologize, in Dallas. You guys change your name, right?
I know we do. We do a lot of financial stuff, so yes, it's okay.
She's wise in all things finance, and she keeps her eye on pretty much everything going on in the world. Thank you for joining us. And, of course, Eric Zorn, the feisty Tribune columnist. That's at Eric Zorn, very easy to remember on Twitter. And on the phone with us is Chrissy McQueer.
Speaking of feisty.
Yes, there it is. And we wanted to bring things locally here. And Kristen, welcome back. I had a question for you. We were talking about this, the idea of what happened in the state fair here in Illinois. It's kind of an active week. Everybody got their day, and I wanted to get your take on what you thought, what the big story was coming out of there.
You know, I don't know that there was or is ever going to come out of the state fair anymore. It used to be this big event where in the old days, I mean, like in the late 1990s, before we had this whole issue of, you know, you can't campaign at all on state time. The state fair was a huge event for both Republicans and Democrats because people were allowed to leave their jobs and head over to the state fair in Springfield. If you worked at the Department of Natural Resources, whatever, you were there, you were part of the rally. Now there has been this line drawn in the sand, which is appropriate, that there can be no campaigning on state time. So over time, the fair has gotten less attended. There's less enthusiasm. It's not this big stage for candidates to preach like it used to be. I would say the couple of items that came out of this year were, you can see what the Republicans are going to try to do again, which is dirty up Mike Madigan. They walked around with buttons with a picture of Mike Madigan when he was first elected, and he looks, you know, very baby-faced and young. I don't know how effective that will be. It really hasn't worked up to this point. And on the Democratic side, you just had people really trying to dirty up Rauner as being an extremist and just hinting that whatever impasse they're at now, it kind of looks like it might continue until 2018, you know, for the next gubernatorial election. So I would say those were the two takeaways. The Democrats are going to try to put up somebody against Rauner, like a Dick Durbin or someone who has a lot of street cred and name recognition. Other than that, the state fair has really fallen in terms of its importance.
What do you think of Durbin as a potential gubernatorial candidate, as speaking, putting on your political analyst's hat and taking off your Republican hat?
Yeah, it's okay. You can say it, Eric. It's okay. You know I love you anyway. I like Dick Durbin. I think Dick Durbin has been a pretty decent senator in terms of, you know, he is an open and unabashed liberal Democrat. His constituent services are really great. He has great appeal to voters statewide. But I just feel like he has, first of all, he's in his 70s.
71, yeah.
Is there no one else on the Democratic side between all of the lawmakers? They hold super majorities in the House and Senate. There's really nobody else who could carry the mantle and be like a younger presence and a more progressive, forward-thinking person for this party. The second thing is he really hasn't been vetted in a way that a statewide candidate should be. I mean, he had Jim Oberweis run against him last time around. Other than that, you know, that was not a top-tier 1, 2, or 3 race. So I look at Dick Durbin as kind of the consummate Washington insider. He has been there since 1984. And with the rise of Bernie Sanders and this whole issue of people not wanting Washington insiders, I think there's probably a lot for the Republican Party to go after with him.
Kristen,
you start digging through his campaign finance reports and who he's taken money from, and I just think he's probably not the best representative for them.
Well, Kristen, Scott Stannis, Mike Madigan's spokesman,
Steve Brown.
Steve Brown was on another radio show station recently, and he was talking about it, and the Durbin candidacy came up, and he was actually walking it back and giving reasons why Durbin would not be a good candidate and probably not be a very good governor. Is there something to be read into that?
Well, what were the reasons? Do you remember?
Age and no executive experience were the two things that he brought up, which are
He's been a legislator his whole career, right?
So, well, I would point out that Steve Brown is the spokesman for Mike Madigan, whose daughter is Lisa Madigan, who I think is probably, she's starting to kind of dip her toe into the water a little bit more with more controversial issues, like ruling that some of Rahm Emanuel's emails and others of public officials have to be released. She is a contender for that race. So the idea that Steve Brown would kind of walk back Dick Durbin, I don't really think is that surprising. She would have her own baggage, of course, to bring. But again, it's always kind of surprising to me that we keep recycling the same people. Well, when you had Bruce Rauner, for example, who kind of came out of nowhere, he was a businessman. Is there no one on the Democratic side to kind of carry that mantle?
Well, who would you see?
Who do you suggest?
Yeah, who in the General Assembly strikes you as likely?
I don't want to get in the business of naming names. I'm just telling you there is a whole progressive movement between the Chicago City Council, between some really, you know, smart and effective Democratic lawmakers in the General Assembly. You have a couple of statewide office holders. You have Mike Frericks, who is the state treasurer. Now, I don't know. I've heard that he's rumored. I don't think he's been vetted either. But, you know, there is this younger crop of more accomplished Democratic advocates, and so it just surprises me that we keep falling back on the same recycled name.
Takes a lot of. I agree with you. It takes a lot of money to run for governor, though. I mean, a guy like Daniel Biss, the senator from the Evanston area, very smart guy, former math teacher, kind of wonky, but may not have the ability on the stump to raise money that you would need to go up against Rauner. Whoever runs against Rauner is going to need a lot of money because he's got a lot of money.
He does. But again, I'm throwing Lisa Madigan's name out there, Mike Frericks, another statewide office holder. I think there are some others, I don't know that there are certain state legislators who feel like they're ready to make that leap, but there are certainly some really good Democrats who, if they could put together a coalition with organized labor, et cetera, could make a decent campaign.
Kwame Raoul's name comes up a lot, doesn't it?
It does, and I'm not, you know, He might be great. I'm not impressed with him as a whole package. I think when he gets pressed on issues, he sort of starts to falter a little bit. He was the person who took Barack Obama's Senate seat, so he has this rising star issue, and he's good. I mean, he's a great state senator. I don't know that he would be the person to go up against someone like Bruce Rauner.
And I just want to remind listeners that Kristen knows this stuff better than just about anybody. She interviews all these candidates,
right.
One-on-one for our endorsement session. So is there any people out there that you run across, Kristen, when you're doing all these interviews, please let us know.
Yeah, please.
I will.
Like, find us a savior.
I have probably 10 names, but I don't want to float them and put them out there just on my experiences with them. But yes, there are really good, smart, reform-minded Democrats in the General Assembly who I think would make a much better case against Bruce Rauner. And, you know, I'm not advocating for them.
You know what's weird?
But I'm just saying they
exist.
You know, it's weird. Dan Rutherford's name has come up recently, saying that he's going to resuscitate his...
What in the name of everything that's holy can he run for?
Yeah, I'm not kidding.
Oh, my goodness.
We may have to put a pin in that because that's a very deep well to go down. Krista McCrory, thank you so much for joining us at Statehouse Chick. Check her out on Twitter if you want to learn something or at least get an idea of what's going on in the state. There is your place to go. This is WGN. Happy Saturday night. The Mincing Rascals on WGN's Saturday Night Special. Amy Guth will be back next week. Fair or not. I am Jeff Carlin. I produce for the Rokan Show. I'm filling in tonight, and I'm sitting with the great Mincing Rascals, Eric Zorn, a feisty columnist from the Chicago Tribune.
Hello.
Susan Schmidt from Westwood in Dallas.
Indeed.
Thank you, Susan. And, of course, Scott Stannis. I got nothing else for you, Scott. What do you got?
Feisty editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune.
Now he's feisty.
I'm stealing your feisty.
Well, speaking of...
I can change.
We had curmudgeon going for you just a little bit earlier, so feisty might be
an upgrade. Feisty.
And resting bee face to describe my resting curmudgeon face.
Exactly. Yeah. Resting sea face? Is that what we'll go
with? No, we're not going there.
Oh, Jeff, boo.
Speaking of people who are getting booed, Ryan Lochte into the Olympics. He's stealing all of the thunder. And somebody who knows everything about all things Olympics, Stacey St. Clair, who's in Rio. Stacey, how are you?
Good. How are you guys?
Very well. Great. Thanks for joining us.
Sure.
So is Lochte Gate over?
I think so. I think Rio has moved on from it. I don't know what's going back on in the United States media wise, but I think it is no longer a distraction for Rio authorities or the games organizers or for the media here. I mean, all those guys are gone now, and you know, the USOC has apologized profusely, and I think it's moved on here.
What's your sense, Stacey, of overall how the crime situation has been down there? Has this been a successful Olympics for Rio in terms of the visitor experience, the tourist experience?
I think, you know, I've sort of called them the good enough games because, there's a lot of things that are left to be desired, you know, buses that don't show up, lots and lots of petty crime. It's very hard to find a photographer here, for example, who hasn't had equipment stolen from them.
Is that common? I mean, in some of these places
I would
think someone would walk off the beaten path and they would run afoul of that, but this is happening in just communal areas, normal places where you'd be like, oh, I'd be safe here.
Yeah, I think it's common in Rio.
I know it's violent.
It's common in Rio. No, I mean, it's like, for example, I was with a photographer in the breakfast room of my hotel last week, and there was a distraction thing in front of us, like a bunch of plates dropping, and then all of a sudden the camera was gone. Oh, I mean, so that is not typical of my Olympic experiences here. And you know, other Olympics, you're in the press room, you can leave your laptop and you know, go to a press conference or leave your laptop and go grab the results sheet or something. You can't do that here. Even to walk 10 feet across the room, we pack everything up into our bags, go and get them, come back.
Even in the press areas? Wow.
Even in the press areas. But that said, you know, for the sort of problems that were predicted here that haven't come to fruition, I have not seen a mosquito. There hasn't been, you know, major violence. There's been no security, major security issues. When you can pull off a games like that, I think you just could call it a success. I mean, they scaled everything way back here. I don't know what you can tell on TV, but like, none of the venues are truly 100% finished. They're good enough to conduct the events. You know, the plane surfaces are fine, but like, if you walk around the arenas or whatever, there's still like wires hanging.
Right, they kind of got it together just in time.
Hey, Stacey, this is Scott Stannis. I was watching things that they're not showing on TV here, but apparently it's happening pretty regularly, and that's booing of U.S. athletes. The boxing venue, apparently, is just over and over. Some of the other athletes are actually broken down in tears because, is this a regular thing, and why?
Well, it depends. I mean, it's not just U.S. athletes. I mean, they pick a favorite, and then they don't just cheer for their favorite. Part of their culture in watching sporting events is you cheer for your favorite and you boo your favorite's opponent. For example, there was a French pole vaulter who broke down in tears because he was booed the entire time. And then when he got his medal, he was competing against a Brazilian who ended up winning the surprise gold. Even when he got his medal, they still booed the French guy.
Wow, that's a serious
sounds like Philadelphia.
That sounds like some hooligans there.
Right, and I was at Fencing. They had to tell the crowd, you can't boo anybody. You can't. We need quiet. You can't, so it's not just America. Yeah,
I'm not sure that's entirely.
But the Americans got booed the entire time. But they'll tell you this is how they watch a soccer match. I mean, I guarantee you the Germans got booed nonstop today.
Well, right, but you also have I mentioned the American boxers, and they're fighting someone from Nairobi, and they're just booing the hell out of the American boxer.
Right.
Because
they're cheering for the underdog.
They cheer for
in their mind. It's the underdog. You know, I was at a U.S. Women versus Serbia yesterday. Serbia had never won a medal ever in volleyball. It was a semifinal match. That crowd, it's a knowledgeable Brazilian volleyball crowd. They, every time the U.S. touched the ball or served the ball, they were booing.
That's all about booing.
But they were cheering for Serbia. I mean, they wanted Serbia to win. And I find it's a little bit jarring to me to hear that sort of booing. But I don't find it to be always anti-American. I was at Rhythmic Gymnastics today, for example, where the U.S. team, who they're all from suburban Chicago, the entire team, they were last. They were the least good team out there. And the Brazilians cheered them on because they were the underdogs and they weren't going to be any world beaters. And they got a great reception from the Brazilian crowd.
That's nice to hear.
I think it's more of an underdog thing. And certainly Michael Phelps never got booed here.
Tell me about Tell me about all the empty seats. Every telecast I've seen, the number of empty seats is amazing to me. I've never seen that in the Olympics. Has people noted that there? Or is that?
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple things in play. First, a lot of those seats already go to sponsors, and I think you've seen a lot of tourists not coming here, sponsors not coming here because of all of the concerns leading up to it. So they're empty for that reason. London had the same problem with sponsor tickets not showing up. And what they did is they invited their military and their volunteers in and sat them in those seats so it would look okay on television.
Like at the Oscars,
Yeah, exactly. And plus, you want the athletes competing to empty stadiums, which is what the track athletes have been, I would say a quarter full some nights over at track. And then also, the average ticket costs more than what, the typical Brazilian family, makes in a week.
How much is that?
In the favelas, they make about $240 a month. And a ticket just to get into, preliminary rounds of rhythmic gymnastics was like $200. That's for one person.
Wow.
So, there's so many things factoring in. The Brazilian economy is in a terrible state right now. So I think it's a lot of things. And I think it's, their archery, for example, isn't a big sport in Brazil. I'm sure people, maybe try to find the money to go to the Brazil-Germany gold medal match, but maybe don't do it so much for kayaking.
Archery is huge here in Chicago. Where is archery big?
I have you lead about it.
Sherwood Forest.
South Korea. It's like the national sport in South Korea.
Well, there you go.
Things you learn.
And knowledge is power. Have you had any sense of the political upheaval that's happening down there right now? Has that impacted the games at all or anything that you're experiencing?
One of the most shocking moments I thought of the openings, and I don't know if it showed on TV, was they had the temporary president, right? They introduced him because their current president is not impeached, but she is, suspended.
She's locked up, right? She can't really move around all too freely. So Dilma Rousseff.
They didn't. they did invite her to the games and she to the opening ceremonies, and she said she wouldn't feel right. The temporary, you know, the interim president comes and they introduce him, and he gets booed. I mean, talk about, you know, people get booed.
Brazilians like their booing. That's what we've learned.
They do, but the whole Brazilian government issue is a mess, and the economy is a mess. And I think when you look at it from the economic structure, having these Olympics may not have actually been a good thing for them timing-wise, because their economy, you know, there's a question of whether they could even build the infrastructure out to get there, if they could support that. And it's a tough political, you know, and stuff. It's very tough.
Well, this is on top of them doing the World Cup, which they did great. From all accounts, that went well. But this is much even bigger. Wouldn't it have been great if it was here in Chicago? We would not have had corruption.
No, not at all.
You almost said that with a straight face. Almost.
But the question isn't, I mean, there are two questions with the Olympics, right, Stacey? Where there's this one, can you pull it off? And it seems like they have pulled it off. As you said, it's the just good enough games, whatever you're calling it.
Mm-hmm.
The other question is, a year from, what's the hangover going to be like, right? A year from now or 6 months from now when a lot of these bills come due. Go ahead.
Look at Sochi. Sochi is a ghost town, and you know, that whole Olympics was supposed to make Sochi, that $51 billion Olympics, was supposed to make Sochi into a tourist destination. That didn't happen, and there was just a study from Oxford that came out right before these games that showed the Russian government is paying $1 billion a year in upkeep of Sochi venues that aren't being used. I mean, so, yeah, what happens in Rio a year from now? I mean, I don't know. They hosted the Pan Am Games in 2007. There are studies that show the four buildings they built for those games were supposed to be for public use, aren't used by the public at all. In some cases, they're empty. So I don't think there's a lot of hope that there is a great legacy of these games. The venues they did build are in sort of their more moneyed part of town, right in Baja de Tuca. And, you know, so that area will benefit. But, you know, the poor people in Brazil are not going to get a benefit out of these games. They're not going to get increased recreational activities, and they'll be left holding the bag if, you know, there's public costs associated with it.
Stacey St. Clair in Rio, can you hang on for a couple of minutes? I'd love to get your thoughts on some of the local athletes, because there are a lot of local athletes you keep writing about, and someone else who's very interesting and very local every day. So I'd love to get your thoughts on that, if you can hang on for a couple minutes here.
Sure.
This is the Mincing Rascals on WGN Saturday Night Special. We will be right back. I am Jeff Carl, and this is the Mincing Rascals on WGN Saturday Night Special. Amy Guth will be back next week, sitting in with me tonight. Scott Stannis, the feisty editorial cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune.
Here it goes. Oh,
I know, it's catching on.
No, I'm losing it.
Curmudgeonly feisty something or other.
Sure.
We'll go with that.
I'll be beloved. How's that?
Beloved Eric Zorn joins us.
Oh, I like that. That's
At Eric Zorn.
Oh, he's going to steal
at Stantis. Susan Schmidt from Westwood in Dallas. And, of course, Stacey St. Clair at Stacey St. Clair in Rio, reporting for the Tribune, and joins us as well. Stacey, the Chicago showings in the Olympics, how awesome has that been so far this year? So far this 2 weeks, rather. It's quite something.
Yeah, I mean, they've done, you know, we won, there was a gold for a Chicago athlete tonight, and Elena Della Dunn from the Chicago Sky took gold in the women's game. I hope I'm not spoiling that, but I'm sure nobody expected them to lose the gold, so I don't.
They only won by 29, so.
How did she do? Because she didn't play as much as I kind of thought she might, being the.
You know, I didn't cover the game. I saw it on a screen occasionally, and I did see her, you know, in. But I don't know her actual playing time. She was definitely, you know, celebrating. I saw the gold medal ceremony, and she was definitely, you know, having a good time there. Like I said, there was five, gymnasts today from they train in Deerfield, the U.S. rhythmic gymnastics team. And they finished last, 14th out of 14. But you know, it was a victory for them. They were the first U.S. rhythmic gymnastics team to ever qualify for an Olympic Games. So just being there was like a great moment for them. And, you know, I like covering that almost as much as I like covering, you know, the people who you know are going to win gold medals or are supposed to win gold medals. Just, you know, sometimes the moral victory is even better than the medal, at least, you know, from a reporter's perspective.
It's much more touching. I love the story of, was it Kent Farrington? Am I saying that right? The local equestrian who...
Show jumper,
correct. This got to start in was it Old Town riding horses for the Hansom Cab horses?
Yeah, he would ride, he wanted to ride horses. So his mom, they lived in Lincoln Park. His mom, you know, found a place in Old Town that was the stable for the horses that, you know, pulled tourists around Michigan Avenue. And he started riding there. That's how he learned to ride a horse. And, 30 years later, he's at the Olympics, jumping. And he won the silver team medal. He was star of the U.S. team, won the silver team medal, and finished fifth. And I know this sounds sort of ridiculous, but he finished fifth in a really heartbreaking jump off the gold medal yesterday that I watched, and that was
Stacey.
That was
I gotta admit, when
it.
You say he learned how to do this on the cozy cab things, I just see him doing the jump, practicing the jumping while he has people in the back of the cab, and it makes me giggle.
Potholes.
I think he actually rode them at the stable when they came back. But yeah, the whole image of someone making the Olympics with that kind of start, I mean, that's what makes the Olympics fun.
They had a 5-way jump off for a gold medal. Because you say he finished fifth.
Actually, it was a 6-way.
Six-way.
Wow. But that's not unusual for that sport.
Now, why
right,
is
Stacey?
That? You said that you were...
It's unusual to have that many in an Olympic final. I think they said it was the biggest Olympic final jump-off ever. Because they were all clean. They were all perfect through the two rounds. And so they needed to go to a sudden death.
The horses were juiced.
sudden death sounds bad to the horses.
Yeah.
Wait a minute here.
The horses here have stricter doping rules than the humans under the guise that humans can sort of control what's being put in their bodies to some extent, as long as they're, not a Russian. But, if the horses have no control over what goes in them. They can't even have chocolate here. Chocolate is a banned substance for horses at the Olympics.
Really?
Why is that?
Because it's not caffeine, but there's a caffeine-like substance in there that occurs naturally. That it is considered a doping.
Can humans?
Violation.
Humans can have chocolate, though.
Humans can have chocolate. The horses
in moderation.
Cannot. They
moderation. In moderation.
Yeah, you don't want a 300-pound equestrian guy because that just gets
that would be bad.
Keep running out of horses.
Humans also eat chocolate on a more normal basis. So horses, you introduce something a little bit different to their bloodstream, and that can, change the impact. But they're trying to keep it very neutral, very, very organic.
Right, but there are some horses on the U.S. team, they tell us, who are chocoholics. So they were trying to, curb those cravings in them with carrots. And I was like, good luck with that.
That never works.
That horse knows it's not the same.
Yeah, as a mammal, I can say that does not work.
Exactly.
So it must have been fun to be down there for the last 2 weeks, right? I mean, you had a good time?
There's a lot of hassles, right, of course, but at the end of the day, today somebody paid me to go watch Pretty Ribbons twirl in a circle. I mean, that's a pretty good gig, I mean, you get to see really, great moments, and you get to see people you get to witness people who have been working toward one goal their whole life, reach that goal. And the Olympics is a lot of problems, a lot of corruption, but then you get moments like that, and you think, okay, this is why the world comes together for something like that.
There was a moment the other day where it was I think it was the men's 200 or 400 meter final where the guy from Puerto Rico, he false started. He was one of the favorites and he did a false start. And one false start in track and you're done.
Yeah.
It's one, I thought it was two.
Yeah.
No, they just changed the rule for this year.
One false start, you're done. So he's weeping on the sidelines and you think, well, of course he is. He's been training for 4 years for this one moment. And he jumps a fraction of a second too soon, and it's over. And that's drama right there, I tell you.
And it's not, it's not like the Cubs who always have next year. Some of these people know there will never be a next time for them. Lake County's Daniel Dennis came back, had retired from the sport after some heartbreaking losses, came back a year ago, made the Olympic team. His Olympics was over in a minute. Yesterday, he lost in a technical fall, and it's just a lifetime of work for that. And he was heartbroken in the interview area afterwards.
You think? I mean, they're probably getting up at 5 a.m. for every day
for four years, and then there's this devastating moment. It's just crushing.
But then there's also a beautiful moment when an American athlete tripped over. And I'm trying to think of the nationalities of the athletes.
Yeah,
stopped and picked her up, and they walked.
Sweden, right? Sweden.
Stacy?
New Zealand.
New Zealand.
New Zealand.
Yes, right, right.
10,000.
Yes, the 10,000, right?
The 10,000.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And you see, like, you know, nothing as dramatic as that, but you see little moments, you know, like that. I mean,
like
you,
what? Tell
you
us
see,
one.
For example, like, I watched a North Korean and a South Korean take a selfie together. I mean, where in the world else is there a chance for that to happen? You know, not in their home countries, certainly not, you know, and, you know, you just see people, like, you know, help each other out, just even, you know, navigating, even not the athletes, even just people at the Olympics trying to figure things out, you know, in different nationalities helping each other and through sign language and things like that, you know.
Stealing each other's cameras.
I mean, that happens, but then, you know, I don't know. I saw University of Chicago student Naomi Grandpierre became the first. She swam for Haiti here, and she became the first woman to ever compete in swimming for Haiti. And I watched the race with her federation, and they were all crying. Not she finished 56th, right? 56th out of 88 swimmers. They were crying because she was going to be on TV that night in Haiti, and she was going to show girls in Haiti, where only 1% of children know how to swim, that it's important to get into a pool. And that's a great message that transcends her 56th place finish here. And, you know, that's a privilege to have, to witness that and to be able to tell people about it.
Stacy St. Clair, at Stacy St. Clair on Twitter, thank you so much for checking in the last couple of weeks and checking in tonight with everybody. You've been doing some great work out there in Rio. Safe travels, and we'll talk to you soon.
Bring all your stuff
all right,
back.
Take care, guys. I'll try. Bye.
We'll check into the news after this. Good evening. Happy Saturday to everyone out there in Chicagoland. This is the Mincing Rascals on WGN's Saturday Night Special. Amy Guth will be back next week. I am Jeff Carlin. I produce here at WGN, most notably for the Rokan Show with Anna DeVontis. It's a bell I ding usually here, but we left it in the other studio. Joining me here tonight, of course, Eric Zorn, the feisty columnist. I don't care what Scott Stannis says. Scott Stannis, streaming editorial columnist.
Beloved.
Or, sorry.
Curmudgeonly.
Yes, exactly. Curmudgeonly, our favorite cartoonist here. And, of course, Susan Schmidt from Westwood in Dallas.
Who needs an adjective, clearly.
The beloved senior vice president.
All-seeing vice president. All-seeing. So we were talking about this in the break. I know we addressed this briefly, but I'd love to get the take on the idea of speeding up the game of baseball. America's game, America's pastime. It is getting slower, even though they're trying very hard to make it faster. But
they are trying to make. I was actually I was in Birmingham, Alabama. I was officiating at my son's wedding. Mazel tov to me.
The Reverend Scott Stannis.
No, okay. The Right Reverend Scott Stannis. And we went to a Birmingham Barons game. They're AA, Southern League, and they have the clock on. They have the batting clock, and they have the change clock. So, and the game moved right along. It was, it seemed intrusive and weird.
The pitch clock is what, 20 seconds?
Yeah. Yeah. You've got 20 seconds to, you know, strike, ball, whatever. And then you've got 20 seconds to.
And if you don't, it's a ball?
I don't know what happens. That never happened. I don't know what happens, Eric. You know these things.
I don't know. A penalty? A spanking?
Yeah. A spanking.
So here's
I don't think that's it.
The commissioner of baseball is now, and I don't know his name. I ought to. I wrote it for my column on Sunday, so I typed it, but I don't know it. He is proposing some various rule changes. One of which is the clock, 20-second pitch clock. The other one has to do with limiting the number of relief pitchers that a team can bring in. Pitching changes, because the game can really get slow when a guy like Madden is bringing in one pitcher, then bringing in another pitcher just to get the left-right matchups that he wants.
But that's part of baseball. That's what I love about baseball. Okay. You luxuriate over it. It's not football.
Do you like replay?
For baseball, no. I think that's preposterous.
See, I love replay.
Why?
Because I'm a truth guy. I know you're not.
But I just think this is the truth of the moment as you perceive it. Let's face it. You're a columnist. I'm a cartoonist. The truth is as we perceive it that day. It can change, but that day, that's what you saw. It was a strike today. Tomorrow might be a ball.
It's an objectively verifiable fact. I mean, when the stuff that we deal with is opinion, it's not an opinion whether someone's out or safe. He is either out or safe. It's just
those are the rules. So I know, but the replay,
you want to slow down a game, go to replay. I mean, good Lord, that's 3 minutes of your life. You're never getting back.
Especially in football. I mean, football is, seconds of play followed by 75 seconds
George
of
Will, who writes poetically about baseball, said, football is the two worst things about American culture. It's extreme violence interspersed with committee meetings.
I love football, but here's my idea for like speeding up baseball. In relief pitchers, no warm-ups. Why do they have to warm up? They can warm
up
in the
bullpen.
They've been in the bullpen. They come. What other sport? Like, say a sub comes in for the NBA. He goes, I just need a couple of shots here to get loose. You've been sitting on the bench for a while. No, they don't do that. No other sport does someone get to come in and practice. What if a kicker in the NFL? They said, okay, you got a 40-yard field goal. The game's on the line. Take a few practice kicks before you try the real one. That doesn't happen. It takes time, and I think it's a great idea.
Okay.
Even between innings, you really don't. They need the time between innings for
concessions, go to the bathroom.
Well, and advertising, well,
yes. And spitting.
But they really. I mean, the idea that every inning we got to get out and throw ground balls to each other, and the pitcher's got to warm up again. Come on, this is a game.
I don't like the replay though. Okay. I think it flies in the face of the tradition.
Well,
of the game.
We've been monopolizing the conversation here. What are the other rascals?
What's the mathematician thing?
Well, I think that it's a reflection that. The fact that we are even talking about speeding up the game of baseball is a reflection on how society has changed. Because we want everything faster. We want quicker delivery. We look at the millennials. They can't wait, 2 seconds. Can I get it on my text? We have a question that we can't answer. We are ourselves, guilty of this. We're Googling the answer right away. We can't wait to find out. We have to find out now. And so it's that immediacy, I want to keep things moving. I need to keep that action going. And so I think you're seeing this pressure to... Scott, as you would say, this time-honored game that has not changed in a century plus, it's sacred and sacrosanct. We can't change it, and replay is offensive. I think we're seeing that everything's got to modify to, keep people's attention there.
I actually did something.
It's still a business.
It's great that
the
you
owners
mentioned
that. Want to have
yes,
people in the stands.
Well, golf has happened. That's what golf is plummeting because it's a long game. And so they're not getting younger people playing it recently. But you mentioned dinner, and I was at dinner with a bunch of friends, and we were debating, who was the president in 1908 or whatever. Because it's
one of these fascinating dinner parties Scott goes to.
I didn't say it was fascinating. I said it was a dinner party. But I said, well, if only we had a device we could look it up. I said, no, we will not. We're not going to pull out our phones. We're going to argue
think
this like our parents
it.
Did.
Right.
And we could be wrong, but damn it.
Like the pioneers.
Wow, you are, a flashback.
Are you have to use Alta Vista? You have to
exactly. You're going to pull out the microphone.
I think I have that on my MySpace page.
Jeff, your opinion?
I will weigh in on this, saying that I love the idea of using replay for very specific things like tag out. Did he beat the ball? Did he not beat the ball? Balls and strikes, I say, no way.
Why not just a scoring play? If it's a scoring play.
Scoring play, maybe foul ball. I mean, I could see that. I get you play on even as the call is, but you can go back and reset. But I think you slow the game down. I think it's too much. You look at the Olympics. They've got replay on everything now, and I think it's really hampered the flow of stuff, especially in volleyball. I mean, it's not a game it's a game that moves really, really fast, and then they stop.
Did you hear about the swimming? Because, they have – it's a tenth and a hundredth of a second, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they say, why don't they go to a thousandth of a second? Because they had two- or three-way
– tie.
Three-way tie in the Phelps.
You know why they don't do it? Because the pool is not exactly accurate. And a thousandth of a second is that long, and it's less than the mistake they can make or the inaccuracy in the length of the pool.
For a record or for the – I mean each lane –
Each lane. There may be a lane that's like 3 millimeters
shorter than
or
the
longer.
Other.
Really?
Yeah, and that can be the difference.
Perfectly straight. Well, think about it. You're putting a pool in the ground. Think about the foundation of your house, right? It shifts over time. The walls aren't exactly where they were set initially. You can't make them that precise.
That's a good point. I never thought
about
that.
Isn't that fascinating?
Precision like that is required, you get thrown off.
So when you go to I think about
so
this,
they can't do it.
I think the measurement on a thousandth of a second in those races was 3 centimeters or millimeters,
wow.
And that is the it's just short of what the warping of a really
right,
well-made pool.
This has nothing to do with speeding up baseball, but it has to do with what Jeff just said about balls and strikes. I think that they ought to have balls and strikes electronically called.
Thank you.
Now wait a minute. That's a complete contrast for you because you were just saying no.
Nothing could change.
But
that's still a ball and a strike. There's a strike zone.
You were all about having it be just a while ago. You're like, well, if it's strike today, it could be foul tomorrow. I don't know.
I know, but this is something you could do.
Susan is on to you, Scott.
You completely switched. That was a 180.
Let's bring on someone who should get a take on this, speeding up the game of baseball. King John himself, John Williams, joins us now from some far-flung location, I'm understanding. Sir, are you there?
Electronic review will ruin baseball.
There you go.
Why? What, not review. What about it? What about an electronic ball and strike zone? The batter steps up and they calibrate where the top of his knees are and the bottom of his armpits, and they know exactly where the plate is, and the ball crosses that zone. It's a strike. If it's not, it's a ball. And the umpire sits back there and eats Pringles.
Yeah, the umpire's union is not going to like that.
No.
Yeah, plus I don't think we'd know exactly how the calibration works. I mean, you'd say the knees are here, and I'd say, no, it should be there, and we'd get into an argument over calibration, Eric.
I welcome that argument, John.
Knees are knees. They've always been knees for crime.
When I was a kid, we were both ways uphill. We had knees.
Well, does this remind you of the argument about when does a person win the 100-meter dash or the 400 when their torso crosses the line or their nose or their toe or
it's
whatever?
It's any piece of them, isn't it?
No, it's not any piece of them. It's torso. That's why they don't reach out with their hand.
It's like this massive part of the human body. I mean, I don't like that.
It bends and contorts. It's not
what
exact.
Do you think it should be, John?
Well, I don't think it should be what they're doing now, which is that you can dive to finish to win.
Right. I was just going to say, what about you can hurl yourself through the finish line at the very last minute, and you're no longer still running, but technically you've crossed the finish line ahead of everybody else before you tumble to the ground.
Well, that's it. So my point is you need to still be running, so you need to be able to take two full steps after you've crossed the line. And if you don't, you're disqualified.
I think it should be the quote-unquote tramp stamp. There should be a tag on the back of the runner's shorts or shirt at that back point. And when that crosses, that's it.
That wouldn't be a bad idea, Jeff, except that it would screw up all the old records. Because
true.
So what about putting it like on the sternum? Say right.
Where all those records are, I mean, are there any ancient records still standing? I mean, everything I see is, Olympic record set 2 years ago, world record set 4 years ago. Right. I mean, if there are really records like that still standing, then maybe. But those records... Hey, you're going to blow past no matter what happens, if we've seen anything in the modern games. So, I don't know.
Well, and you had the Japanese Paul Volter?
oh, dear.
Yes, who's, how can I put this, manhood knocked the stick off when he was going over. Apparently, he was excited to be there.
That's so immature of you, Scott.
I'm just reporting the news. You decide.
The news breaks out. We break down. Yes, that was a tragic story that took the headlines, unfortunately, from a lot
of. So, is that what I called in for? Is this what we're talking about?
You missed all the good political arguments earlier. McQuarrie and I were. I'm glad she wasn't in the room because we were feisty. We were both feisty this morning.
Yeah, she gave us. She read us the rule book.
She thinks Hillary Clinton's getting a break.
Yeah.
That's the thing. Hillary. She's been getting such a break.
I know you guys have already done it, but. Don't you think there's still enough time for this thing to turn around and go the other way?
Oh, sure.
Oh, of course.
Oh, yeah, of course.
It's inevitable we're going to start seeing stories about Trump's comeback because he's going to perk up in the polls.
Well, because he's so far down, right? Yeah. You've heard all these negative events. It's got to reverse. So.
Yeah, but I think the kind of advice he's getting now is suddenly, I mean, the last time he spoke, it was so much more like a real politician. I mean, almost comically so. I mean, I think he was acting like somebody who is trying out for the role of president in the eighth grade play. And he was reading the lines the way he thought a president should. And it kind of worked, but it kind of sounded amateurish, but it was better than him just going off half-cocked. And I think the better he gets at that, I swear to God, I think there's enough time for that to start to resonate,
I think you're absolutely right. I think people were kind of knocking him in the shakeup of his campaign, But that's been his go-to all along. He's like, I know when I need to replace people. That's my thing. I know when
right.
I need
he's
to bring
nimble,
in the right person.
He's willing to change mm-hmm. and do whatever's necessary to get things right.
Now, if he's picking the right people, I don't know. But he's willing to be that person.
Actually, Susan, you work in the financial world.
Yeah, how are the financial people feeling about all this?
Oh, not good. Just not good at all.
What's your opinion of him, and what do they feel about this?
For the stock markets, it's tough because anytime there's a change, the stock market likes certainty, so it doesn't like the unknowns. Here, we don't have an incumbent. We are moving to a new person no matter what. So that immediately raises the level of concern slightly. Hillary here, for the stock market and for business, is considered slightly more of a known quantity just because they've had her around longer. They're familiar with the policies, et cetera, that she's been associated with before. So there's some comfort level there. Trump truly is, even though he claims to be a man of business and finance, he really is a complete unknown because we don't have any idea of his policy or his directions. And the way that, you know, he's been in real estate, his business is very different. When he talks about trade tariffs and how he's handling the economy and international import exports and taxes, it's very confusing and contradictory. So the market gets really nervous about that.
Does he know what he's talking about? I mean, is his success in business rooted in a really wise understanding of business, do you think?
Well, one, you can argue that either way. He's certainly been successful. Now, he hasn't revealed his taxes. He has not gone through the same level of financial scrutiny that, so here, to put, I'll go back on being Kristen here for a second. He has not gone through the same level of financial scrutiny that we put the Clintons through. That's for sure. We haven't had access to a lot of his documents. We have seen him over the decades where he's been involved in things. He's had bankruptcies. He's had buildings that haven't worked out. He's had to turn things around. Sometimes he hasn't turned things around and they failed. That's not what we're being presented with. The stock market is looking at that, seeing a familiarity with him and going, we're still not sure because his policies are crazy. At least with Hillary, they have a better idea of what she might bring to the table. But overall, the market is just concerned. Neither one of these candidates is particularly pro-business or pro with policies that are making the market feel more comfortable.
She is Susan Schmidt. King John, can we hang on to you for a few minutes? We're going to take a quick break, if that's all right with you, sir.
Yeah, I've heard about commercials.
Thank you, sir. We will do some more of the Mincing Rascals on WGN Saturday Night Special after this. Good evening. This is WGN. I am Jeff Carl, and this is the Mincing Rascals live edition. I am sitting at the helm here while King John is on the phone, which is a turn of events that I never thought would ever happen in my career. But thank you, gentlemen, for joining us. And ladies, we have with us Eric Zorn from Tribune, Susan Schmidt from Westwood in Dallas. Scott Stannis is here. Yay. And, of course, King John. Thank you, sir, on the phone.
You guys are sounding great. I'm at a wedding reception in Pittsburgh right now.
Well, I love Pittsburgh.
Wow. Great town. My wife's from Pittsburgh.
Yeah, you know, when you drive into town, it's lovely. We're having a good time. I mean, props to Pittsburgh. Shout out to Pittsburgh. It's nice.
Yeah. There you go. Are you getting ready to catch the bouquet?
No, but you know what? My wife and I know how to dance a little bit, but more ballroom
dance. Oh, very nice.
Social. Yeah, but they're not playing any ballroom dance music. Would it kill them to play one slow song?
Yes.
It probably would.
That is so true. It's not my wedding.
It would kill them. You go and give that DJ a piece of your mind, John. That's my advice.
Yeah, I'll tell him. I'll use the "Do you know who I am?" line.
Do that.
I have radio shows in major markets. I'm a major market radio personality.
Speaking of knowing people's names, there's a great story that kind of closed out the week here in Chicago of a local judge letting an attorney and an aspiring judge sit in their garb. I don't know, John, did you see this? I'm sure you did.
Yeah. And Markham, right?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Judge Valerie Turner, who allegedly allowed Rhonda Crawford sit in and wear the robe and
preside.
Yeah.
Preside over a couple of cases, supposedly.
A bizarre thing. Have we ever seen anything like this?
The Mincing Rascals podcast. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, Eric and I had a turn on this with Steve Bertrand, and I was trying to downplay the awfulness of it, but I think I just kind of ticked people off in the process.
Well, the thing is that nothing serious happened. It was all symbolic. I mean, she heard a couple of traffic cases that have to be reheard. But an incredibly poor judgment on the part of the sitting judge.
Oh, yeah.
Who probably ought to be a disbarring offense. Incredibly poor judgment on the part of the aspiring judge. I mean, the story is this woman is running for judge. She's a shoo-in at the in the election. So it seems like, well, hey, why don't you try on this robe? I mean, you want to see how it fits? And she put it on, and like, boy, this feels good. And then, hey, you want to go sit on the bench and see how that feels? And to me, it sounded like the premise for a madcap movie. Like she goes out there and sits down, and then she somehow inadvertently frees an international diamond thief, and then hilarity ensues. So I think there's some potential here, but it also the deeper story is to look at is how judges are selected in Chicago, and how. You know, this woman who is what was her name, Judge Rhonda, or the lawyer Rhonda.
The lawyer's name is Rhonda Crawford.
That she was just selected. The political process really doesn't work that well for judges. That this woman was not recommended by several bar organizations, and there's no chance she's going to lose, unless of course she gets disbarred at this point. But which is possible, I guess.
I'm actually reminded of the Castro brothers, who one of them was the mayor of San Antonio, and on some occasions, like the Riverboat Festival or whatever, his brother would fill in for him. Yeah, like Mr. Castro is now president's cabinet. But yeah, so it must be a Democrat thing. Is that what you people do?
Like a Patty Duke show or something.
Because because they're judges, identical judges.
There you go. Maybe it's wrong. Maybe it's not a movie. Maybe it's a running TV show.
Yeah, you know, the Chicago spinoff, Chicago Court, two wacky judges.
Yeah, we've got Chicago, everything else, fire, sanitation, PD. Why not?
Well, what's the best way to select a judge? Is it, okay, right, nobody pays attention, and sometimes we elect people who have Irish names or we're just voting the ticket. And so people get elected without us having any sense of their merit. You say, okay, we don't know enough to decide who a judge should be. Let's let the governor decide, or the mayor decide, or the Supreme Court justices. I mean, so do you want to let somebody point that and say, I don't like that either? This has been a conundrum for me for the longest time.
Here's the simplest.
Ballot, you don't know who to vote for.
I'm sorry. Here's a quick answer is the Missouri plan. They're appointed by an executive governor, mayor, county commissioner, whatever, and then the people vote yay or nay on the appointment.
How does that help?
I don't know that solves the problem, though, because the people are still going, oh, great, one appointment, I'll vote yes here.
They can, but it does give the people the right, and the presumption is that there is some vetting other than they're on the card that the Democratic party handed to me before I voted, or the Republicans.
Do you want to do our recommendations? We use the Mincing Rascals podcast with recommendations for what you're watching, listening to, or not dancing to?
The case well... here's what got Steve Bertrand all annoyed, because we talked about this on our podcast that you can hear on the Mincing Rascals podcast. It's on our Facebook page and on WGN Plus. But all I was trying to tell Steve and Eric was, it's not like it was a murder case or the international diamond thief. It was low rent stuff that I'm sure a judge and an attorney could just as easily as you or I figure the guilt or innocence or the, you know, what the outcome should be. And so was this that bad? And then they all started screaming at me when I said that.
So, John, you want to do a recommendation?
Oh, the recommendation for me this week will be Malcolm Gladwell's podcast, which is Revisionist History.
Revisionist History.
I only recently discovered it. And Brenda and I have been listening to it driving across country this week. Oh, my God, 30-minute podcast. It's how spoken words should be. I highly recommend that. That's what we're listening to this week.